Before I have you jump on there, Raghu, if I can just, I just want to interrupt you for one quick second. I just want to give some of the folks on the call some context that I don't believe everyone knows you, and then just trying to, you know, I guess sort of set a framework around some of what we would like to hear from you today as well, from both of you actually. And so for those of you that don't know Raghu and Nisha, they actually grew up in India and they met each other when they were young. And apparently Raghu was one of those lucky guys that got to marry the girl next door. And they live and worked in India before coming to the U.S. But after about being in the U.S. for about, I think, 8-9 years, something shifted within them. And they decided to sort of change the course of their lives, move to India, and sort of walk a different path. And so that's kind of what we were hoping to hear a little bit about today. And so, you know, maybe a little bit, we could start with a little brief history on sort of your connection to both of your connections to sort of service-based charity focus. Maybe hear some of the memorable stories or key moments that you've had over the years just in your service journey that helped lead to, you know, what I guess a lot of us would consider that true Be the Change path that you guys have chosen in returning to India to live this sort of live sustainably, let's call it. And then maybe tell us about what it is that you guys are doing out there. And Akanch and I have prepared a bunch of questions, but I think that will probably be good to kind of see this off for now.
For me, I think my luckiest 5 minutes of my life were those 5 minutes when Raghu just chanced upon Nipun's speech in San Francisco, where Nipun was given 5 minutes to present charity focus. And I truly mean it, though lucky is like a cliched word. And like if I had to kind of, you know, fast forward, I've stumbled upon this truth of, you know, having a relatively simpler living, having relatively more time, and not, you know, working for companies like PlayStation. And I stumbled upon this truth a lot many times while it was at, you know, maybe listening to Dream Festival, maybe listening to KPFA, you know, a lot of times. But as the saying famously goes, I've always managed to pick up myself and walk away from the truth. I think one night, maybe I was pregnant with Om about 5 months, maybe. And then at midnight, I just woke Raghu, and then, you know, told him, you know, let's move back to India. I think at that time, my thought was, he's going to call me crazy, or let's talk about it in the morning, or one of those usual responses. So, you know, very surprisingly, he said, okay. And then we both went back to very peaceful sleep. And I think very shortly after that, maybe within a year or even less, even as we were kind of preparing, and then got lost in Om's arrival and all the associated things, we had this special evening with Bolozov at Nipun's place. And Bolozov is full of grace and is very direct with words in a very compassionate way. And he hit home with 3 points. He said his purpose in life for choosing the path that he has chosen is A, to not accumulate, to do something of common good, and 3, to be spending some time alone. Those are not his exact words, but you know, going against accumulation of material wealth and indulging in some work that is good for oneself and good for others, and being able to spend some time in contemplation. Those were, you know, the broad outlines of the path that he had chosen for his life. And it just hit home, and I didn't quite hear what he spoke after that, because I was just in a trance, and I'm like, haven't I thought very same thoughts before? And yet, when somebody who has lived it sees it, it makes you want to act. So then, I think in a couple of days, we had a home for sale, and from there, everything moved eastward. So I think the connection to Clarity Focus and the rights and lefts that we have taken in our life, those are unmistakable. And almost everything we can trace back to Charity Focus, for better word, because we don't have words to trace it back beyond that. So the buck stops there with Charity Focus, for all the good things that have happened to us. So that's a little bit of the history. And so once we moved back, we were always thinking about having a small piece of land and being more social. Like, before our focus was more like, let's do some work that is more social, and then we'll have a small piece of land so we don't have to worry about food. But it so happened that we ended up with 2 acres of land, and that is roughly 88,000 square feet, and even more land by way of our friends buying adjoining parcels. So suddenly, two things become clear. A, to be this guardian of this collective space, that itself takes a lot of work, and it gives a lot of joy. And seeing trees grow, seeing things change, and seeing Om be in communion with butterflies, seeing him learn to be alone and be happy. Those things, and seeing all the questions that arise in him. But the time for contemplation also puts forward in a very clear way one's limitations. So we built a community center, and we even built toilets and bathrooms for it, but we have not done anything there yet, because I personally don't feel I'm prepared for community or external activities yet. So there is some framework for our life with macro things like right food, and right work, and right sangha, right friends. But the other element of right thought, that is still, a little ziggy-zaggy here and there. And it looks like the macro is okay, the micro is a little misaligned here and there. Like, for instance, this morning, a couple of children of the lady who works at my farm sometimes, her name is Sivagani, so a couple of her kids came along, and one kid resembles his father, two boys actually. The elder boy resembles his father very much, who's like a very genuine guy and all that. The second kid, for some reason, I think, resembled his aunt, who has cheated us many times. And I could see the subtle shift in me when I was dealing with these two kids. I was reading a book to them, but I was really only reading to one of them a little more. So the right thought is something that I need to perfect, and before I can do what we thought we could do, or maybe even not, I don't know. But what has happened on the positive side a lot is, like, right food. There's a very nice group of friends here, and we found a really nice Gandhian kind of a teacher who expounds on this theory of natural living, as in, like, the right way to eat and the right way to metabolize. So we have a very Karma Kitchen kind of setup. We do camps that are 7 days and residential. So a lot of opportunity for volunteering, and we serve 6 meals and snacks and drinks per day, all 7 days, with night stay and therapies and everything. And every time before we take out, even if it is just a soup or a drink, there's a prayer and blessing for the food, which puts the volunteers at a very different level, as they serve. There's a little bit of pride that I notice in myself and other people when we roll out, like, 500 chapatis within a span of 2 hours. But then when we offer that prayer, the pride just melts away, and the pain also melts away, backaches and wristaches and whatnot. So we do these camps, and it started with 18 people attending, and then now we have like 120 people attending with no advertisement. So these camps have given us a very nice way of anchoring ourselves into service. in very real way with a lot of physical work as well as engaging in something very holistic. My typical work day is, you know, split between the farm, the house, cooking and homeschooling home. So I feel very fulfilled there. And there's plenty of time for meditation. So like today at 11:30, I finished my work and I had an hour before lunchtime, 12:30 usually. So I looked out and the farm was being well taken care of, so I could just go into meditation for an hour. So I think I have a very luxurious life in some ways. There's a lot of, responsibility to that power. I'll let Raghu take over from here.
Thank you, Disha.
Thank you, yeah.
That was so beautiful.
Hey, so I just want to front load the punchline. Because when I was thinking, what should I share, and somehow this thing came up. So the luxury that Nisha is talking about just now refers to the freedom that we have. So whatever I'm going to talk now is going to lead to this freedom, and I'll tell you why that is relevant. The charity focused connection, I would put it this way, you know, it is usually said that the subject of philosophy can be categorized as pre-Socrates and post-Socrates. That's what they say, because this guy came in between out of nowhere and, you know, kind of made the transition from a mythological way of looking at the world to a rational way of looking at the world. So I would say that with respect to our lives, and I'm sure so many friends we have and so many other people's lives, it can be, you know, the life itself can be divided into pre, charity focus, and post. And so the prelude for meeting Nipun for me was that, and I usually don't go into much of details when I say this to people, but maybe now I will a little bit. You know, I came to Bay Area in 2000 beginning, and I was doing a tech startup. And so obviously meeting a lot of people and investors and whatnot. So we were like a 4 or 5 member team, all working on equity, working really hard and all that. And I had a bunch of friends in the Indian community who were already like, you know, rich people, kind of, you know, people who have really made it. And so I was meeting with a bunch of these successful entrepreneurs. And one of them kind of took me under his wings and, you know, started introducing me to a lot of these people. And, you know, besides trying to learn from their experience and wisdom and all that, I was also looking at their lives. You know, what are they doing with their lives? And, you know, very soon, something became very clear that none of them had really any clue about what do they want to do with their lives, which was a big surprise for me, because the usual thinking is that if you make a lot of money, you would not have to work for a living, and you would have a lot of time in your hands. And with a lot of money and a lot of time, you can figure out what you want to do in your life. That's the usual track people take. So I was on the same thing. But here I'm meeting people who are worth, I don't know, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And basically they are telling me that they don't know what to do. And, you know, that was a shocker. And, you know, one of them was actually our yoga student. You know, we used to teach yoga while we were there every Saturday. And one of them was actually a student. And so I had a heart-to-heart conversation with him one day and said, you know, so what's going on with you? You know, why are you hanging out in the Bay Area? Why are you investing in more companies? And, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? So this guy then tells me, you know, Raghu, once I made my money, I went around trying to see what I can do with my life, and every time I tried something, it didn't work out. And after a few trials, I sort of came back to what is familiar, and I'm just here. So that started getting me think about whether, you know, making money is really one route to, you know, gain the freedom. So I started thinking a lot about freedom, you know, what it really means and all that stuff. And in that course, you know, I started meeting a lot of NGOs and trying to see what they're doing. And Nishan, I started thinking of some kind of a technology for non-governments. And in that context, I happened to go to this Planet Works gathering where they used to gather every week and allow NGOs to present themselves for 5 minutes each. So that's how I met Mithun. So the epiphany was that when I listened to him for 5 minutes, there was this sense that I don't need to really know anything more about this person. There was a sense that, you know, just that 5 minutes was enough to know everything I need to know about this person. So I just went up to him and said, you know, I had this usual thing of asking people that what is their wish list, kind of makes conversation easy. And makes the connection later also easy. So I just asked him, you know, do you have a wish list? So he said, yeah, I have three. So then I kind of invited him to my place the next day. He came, and then, you know, it all started like that. So anyway, so post Charity Focus, it was an amazing time of meeting with so many people who have done a lot of great things in small and big ways, which kind of anchored and showed us real-world examples of theory which we had up our head. And so it went on like that, and we shifted to India and started farming, built a greenhouse, meaning, you know, a building which can be green certified and stuff, and then got on to the next thing now, which is called Life Natural, which is the naturopathy way of growing and eating food. So there are basically three things we do now, which is natural farming, one, and natural living, which is basically, you know, right eating, basically in terms of health, but it's also a little more than that. It kind of connects you to what you grow, what you eat, and kind of influences you that way. And the third thing, of course, is vipassana, the meditation that we started doing. Mostly because of Viral, and that we continue now. So these are three things we do now. And in the course of living the life we live today, in the last 3 years, probably close to 200 people have contacted us on their own through different connections. And of them, the usual thing is that either they are going to quit their jobs, they're thinking of it, or they've already quit their jobs. And they all want to do something, and they're all seeking that something. And it all comes down to most of them asking us, how did you do it? And, you know, what's the secret? Or, you know, how did you get the courage? And stuff like that. And, you know, last year we had this retreat in Ahmedabad. About 40 people had come from around India to share things, and you know, Nipun had asked us to make a presentation, and I was thinking up a theme from our presentation and came up with one which basically said, easier done than said. So that seems to be the real case, that whatever we are doing is more easy to do than to explain. Because once you get into explanations and analysis, it gets more and more complicated. So I have done this explanation now to, I don't know, maybe 200-300 people in person, over emails, over phone calls, in different ways. And then one day I was just randomly reading some web page and came across, you know, somebody talking about Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi is, you know, one of the great saints of South India. And he was talking about freedom in that article. And he basically says in that article that he doesn't have freedom. And that was like really surprising, because he was supposed to be an enlightened person and he's saying, I don't have freedom. And so I read a little more, and he says, you know, freedom can be classified into two categories, at least two categories, basically. He says, one is called freedom from, the other one is called freedom to. And he says, the second one I don't really have. He says, you know, when I look at my janitor, I'm really jealous of him because, you know, he can do whatever he wants. But I, you know, hanging out in the ashram, if somebody rushes up to me and says, you know, hey, you're a visitor, I have to rush to my room and then sit there in a dignified manner. So he says, I really don't have freedom to do things. But what I do have is freedom from. He says, I have freedom from a lot of different things, essentially boiling down to two kinds of freedom, which is freedom from cravings and freedom from aversion, which is what, you know, Buddha taught and all the great saints taught. And so that finally kind of told me is what we have. That's the freedom we have today, which has given us whatever we have today. So the two kinds of freedom that we have today are freedom from craving and freedom from aversion. Not completely, of course, but the big ticket items. You know, freedom from cravings would be things like, you know, freedom from wanting money and wealth, freedom from not wanting fame and name and all that, and freedom from, you know, not wanting to have power, and freedom from, you know, not wanting an iPad, all that. Maybe a little bit of that I have. So basically, the big ticket items of cravings are gone completely, and also the aversions, you know, freedom from aversion towards you know, nations and people and religion and, you know, conditioning that we have, and all kinds of things that, you know, make people hate each other and not like each other or limit oneself to the condition we have, you know, freedom from all of that. But one of the most important aversions that I think Nisha and I have managed to overcome, I don't know to what degree, but at least to a substantial degree, is freedom from aversion towards insecurity. Now that seems to be the really big thing, because everywhere we turn around, just about everyone we meet is into some kind of insecurity or other, which is the biggest hindrance they are facing to do what they really want to do in their lives. And acceptance that life is insecure anyway, acceptance that absolutely there is no security anyway, look at it. That, I think, did it for us in terms of doing pretty much everything else we did. So this freedom from cravings and not really getting caught up in that, and freedom from aversions, at least this one big one called insecurity, has given us this freedom from these two things, and that, I think, has pretty much decided everything else for us. And the positive side of, one of the biggest positive side of that is that we realize you really do not have to go after anything at all in your life. All you need to do is, you know, the way I explain it to people these days is that past charity focus, we were going on a linear path. You know, we used to be at point A and want to go to point B, which is, you know, one of the short-term goals of our purpose, and then work towards it. So you reach point B, or maybe you reach point B1 or whatever, but the arrival is never satisfying, wherever you are. And then you have to find a new target called point C and keep going towards that. So life had been a linear journey until that point. And beyond that, where we are today, we see life as not a linear path. We see it as, you know, you just draw a circle and then sit in the center and say, I'm not going anywhere. And I don't want anything. I don't want to go anywhere. I'm done with ambition. And I just want to put all the values I have, all the work I can do within this one circle, and see what happens because of that. And that state is something that I and both of us really relish. And you know, there's this famous statement by investors that don't put all your eggs in one basket. And one of the turn of the phrase I thought of later was that what we are actually doing is that putting all the baskets in one egg. It's, you know, what I'm trying to say is that the journey here is inward. And so I'm done with baskets. So I'm just putting all the baskets in one egg and let that go. You know, let that egg mature, let that egg break, so that we can break out of the shell and see what emerges out of that egg. So that's the luxury of the freedom and how we arrived at it. And just one more thing, couple of minutes, which the one key insight I had out of the 10 days Vipassana we did was that, you know, every day, whoever has done Vipassana would know that S.N. Goenka, Sri Goenka, who is the teacher of the course, he does a, you know, 1-hour lecture, video lecture at the end of the day. And I was listening to these lectures on third or fourth day. I was asking myself, how come he's not making any mistakes? Like, he's doing extempore, you know, he's not referring to anything, he's just talking. And he's able to weave so many things into that 1 hour lecture, which is like a masterpiece of presentation. And I'm just wondering, how is it possible and what is he actually doing? And then at some point during one of the meditation, sort of insight came up, which was that they say, you know, in psychology, there's the four stages of competence they talk about. Initially, you know, you're unconsciously incompetent, which is you don't know what you don't know. And then later, the next stage is you become unconsciously incompetent. Consciously incompetent. So now you know what you don't know. And the third stage is you become consciously competent. And the fourth stage is you become unconsciously competent, which is that the competence gets internalized. So you don't have to think about it anymore. So if you take the example of driving a car, somebody who's experienced in it is not even thinking about pulling the steering wheel or pressing the accelerator or anything. You just keep driving because you're competent and consciously. And then I knew from just my past readings that some others had contemplated on existence of a fifth level. And however much people tried, they were not able to clearly define the fifth level. And the closest they came to was saying that somebody is being consciously competent of being unconsciously competent. It's kind of a contradiction in terms and confusing. So I was noticing Goenka and asking myself, what is he doing? Is he being consciously, unconsciously competent, or is he doing something else? And I felt that he is actually doing something else. And what that something else didn't really click. And some maybe eighth day or ninth day it clicked. So I was asking myself, there are only two things here. One is consciousness, another one is competence. And so if he is doing something with these two things, but he is not at any one of these four levels, where is he? You know, what is he trying to do? And then it happened, you know, somehow it happened. All I had to do was just turn around the phrase. He's being competently conscious. It is a context-free state. You know, it's not associated with a particular skill or a particular task or anything. He's being very competently conscious. That's what he's being. So at that point, when you go to that level, you're context-free, meaning you could just, you know, sweep your floor, do your dishes, and be as conscious as doing whatever else you're doing with your life. So that kind of did it for me in terms of, you know, this one insight alone is worth it for a long time to come now. So that one thing I took away from my last course, that trying to be competently conscious, which is, in other words, being mindful, that's what they say, but put it this way, I kind of understood it much better. So that those were the two things I wanted to share. The luxury of the freedom from, and the aspiration of wanting to be competently conscious. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I add just one thing to that? Maybe it will take 3 minutes.
Take as long as you want. Yeah.
Okay, I'll take 2 minutes. When Raghu was talking about insecurity, I just wanted to flesh it out a little bit. I was not completely insecure, free from insecurity in the beginning, and I don't think I am now. It's just the degree that has changed. And, you know, there were times I would check my bank balance once in a month or so. But at some point, I think these long walks that we take in the farm or in our farm or other farms or whatever it is, something changed. It's now so difficult for me to unlearn it that for me, true wealth right now, if it has to be in some external form and not in an internal form, that would be trees above the ground and water under the ground. I think with that, I don't know if it is a step one of some realization or maybe I stop here, but once that happened, once that became internalized and I cannot change it now, then just looking at the bank balance, that part stopped. I haven't logged into my bank for more than 7-8 months now. Maybe I should The one thing that we are part of now, the one other thing that we are part of now is like 2-3 very good communities that take up wasteland restoration. So I think now we have some money, and now it looks more like a problem than a solution. It looked like the beginning of the solution, but then it looked like the problem. But now I think we've struck the balance where we can say very safely that all our savings will go to something like a wasteland restoration initiative. And now we are part of 2 good communities that do this kind of restoration. And it's almost magical to go back to these places once in 3 months or 4 months and see the change that happens just because somebody is there, caring for it. Many of these people are software engineers, and many of these people are activists, and many of these people are hardcore, everyday people. So I just can't put a pattern on this and say these kind of people care more for Earth than others or anything like that. I think our environmental consciousness, at least here in India, has gone up quite a bit since I knew last time. And so I see a lot of positive things, and I see a lot of genuine people who are actually working double shifts and triple shifts to make this happen. So so I'll be very happy if somebody wants to come here and do some or learn some kind of restoration stuff. There are enough places that we can find it.
I'm not even sure really where to begin, aside from where do I sign up. I want to open it up to anyone if they have any questions that they want to ask. There was one thing that I wanted to ask that, several weeks ago we had Arthi as a guest speaker, and she was telling us about the summer bike, and one of the key truths that she seemed to discover was the importance of selecting the right person or persons you walk the path with in life. And though perhaps that's, not so rare in the service-based community, it can be rare to find sort of those life partners who are highly motivated to walk this certain path. And so, can you guys tell us a little bit about how you keep each other going, because spiritual personal growth process it's unique to each individual, where an obstacle for one person is an afterthought for another. And so would love to hear just a little bit about that aspect of your life.
You know the answer best for this question. So when you ask that question, I don't know. Guri can answer it better, I think.
That was Amit.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amit. So, see, the one thing that kind of fell in place for Raghu and I was that we met at an age when we were not so set in our mindset. And our mental models had not fully formed. We were not too rigid. We were 16. In those days, we wrote each other long letters. Some of them look pretty stupid if we read it now, but all of them have this common thread. Both of us were trying to learn something from each other. So there were lots of questions, and there was lots of expressions and questions. So in some sense, we grew together, and both of us have a very candid whatever. So we are not so much like, I'll tell this to Raghu behind the scenes or anything like that. If something comes up, we just say it's good or bad, and we take it at face value. Not that we are perfect, as a couple. I think I yelled at him even this morning. So, but he tolerates me, and if I have to put it in a kind of a model, I think there's the static and the dynamic, and there are many aspects in which I would stay on the static and nurture that static when he would peep out and reach for the dynamic. And maybe in some things I do the same. But there are many bold steps that he would take that look like total craziness to me, but I just keep quiet because I know it is his nature, and nothing that I say or do is going to help it. But you know, just keeping quiet or giving that space and time vindicates many things later. So that's the only thing I can say. Like, to grow spiritually, you need to be mindful of what your partner is doing, and that at the same time, I also need to be stepping a little bit away and also be sharing enough. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. I'll give it to Raghu anyway.
Hey, so I just want to share something that happened in one of the Wednesdays. You know, one of the Wednesdays during the circle of sharing, somebody had a really bad toothache, and so that person was asking everyone else whether anybody has an idea what to do about it. So all of us gave, you know, different inputs, you know, ranging completely philosophical to, you know, something practical. So people were offering all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was a guy who was into martial arts. I forgot his name. So this guy was sitting next to me, and the guy who had toothache was sitting next to that guy. So he was the last guy to pick the mic. And his input was that he's the guy whose tooth is aching, he says, you know, your tooth is going to ache even more. That was his input. So, you know, first of all, he didn't even bother to address the problem. You know, he didn't bother to offer any solutions. He first told him, it's going to get worse. And then he said, there's pretty much nothing you can do about it. You just have to deal with it and get over it. So, you know, initially it looked like, you know, he was a boxer, you know, the guy who gave this reply. And initially it looked like, you know, something coming from a macho guy. But I have recollected that thing so many times over and over again, and realized there's little more than macho-ness to that statement that he made. So with respect to, you know, all questions related to love, romance, finding the right partner, keeping the right partner, you know, with respect to all these questions, my reply is that there's no way to do it. It's not something you can do. It's not in the realm of doing something. If at all I have to put it, I would say it's in the realm of being who you are. I mean, right from a partner happening to you to, you know, a cherished partnership and life for several decades, the whole thing, every day of it, is nothing at all to do with something that you can do. If so, then of course, how do you address the question? So that, the one answer is that, you know, typically in charity focus, we say that we don't network, you know, we don't go around and network. We don't seek out people in order to get something. We just do our thing and practice our values and let the network happen to us. That is exactly how charity focus has grown from what it was to what it is today. So I don't think one can really do anything at all in order to find, attract, etc., a right partner. So that's one. Another one, even under some circumstances, if you happen to find somebody or somebody happens to find you, and some kind of a relationship starts, every step of the journey, it's all coming back over and over again to who you are. Because the bottom line is that every single person is going to make a huge number of mistakes before, during, and after partnering with somebody. And the wise thing, I think, is to know how to look at those mistakes and if necessary, what to do about them. And at the core of it, who you are, if that is authentic enough, I think that has more power to sustain and nurture a relationship than just about anything else. And in which means, essentially, the secret, if you want to call it that, of finding and making a relationship with a person and then sustaining it over your life, the secret of all of that is nothing to do with the partner. It's everything to do with you. Meaning you cultivate yourself, you dig into yourself, who you are, your presence, your whatever, that has the power for everything in your life, including this part of it. So that's the thing. So the short answer is that you really cannot do anything, and that's not really a discouraging statement. So that pretty much it is. You cannot do much about it, but you can only be yourself and go with that.
I wanted to follow up. This is Nipun. I'm curious to know how Om has affected your inner and external ecologies in which you're operating.
No, Nipun, when I read Gil's special Wednesday, and then he said, for 2 years, the pirates are going to take over this. I was so relieved, because that's exactly what happened to us, and I kept thinking that maybe I was not this super mom who could balance this and that and that. But when my meditation suffered for 2 years, and I blame it fairly on Om with guilt certification now. But I think for 18 months after he was born, I remember it distinctly, because I thought, oh, he turns 18 months today, and then I wasn't looking at him anymore every minute. So some switch, some insecurity switch turned off after 18 months, which means that insecurity switch was very big in those first 18 months. But now he's our cop, he's our meditation cop, Dharma cop. He'll be like, if I'm like talking to Raghu and then he's talking back and we are doing it in English, he'd come and say, you are debating. not And sometimes he doesn't understand the context, so we were like, dialing into a dance talk, a special talk, and then he came and said, Amma, too much computer. No good. If we don't sit for meditation every night, before when it was flaky, with all the construction work happening, we used to cut ourselves a lot of slack, and we wouldn't meditate every day, but he would make us meditate at least for 10 minutes. He'd be like, otherwise we're all going to die, and you better become wise by meditating. So, and he's very afraid of death. I think it's because he sees a lot of things dying and being reborn every day. So he has created his own worldview of death and birth. So when some insect dies inside the house or an ant is dead, he would take it very carefully on a piece of paper and bury it near a flower always, and says, this ant will turn into the next flower, this plant will give out. And he'll say, be happy, and then, and he'll be happy about that too. He doesn't have regrets about them. But when it comes to his own death, he's like petrified. So I think I've not documented it, but I think he has asked at least like 38, 39 questions about death that are different ways of asking the same question, which is, how can I beat it? And it all started because him, me, and my mom were lying together in the bed, and he asked, where's my mom's mom? And so since then, he hasn't, there's always an undercurrent of that in him. Mortality in him, which is kind of driving him nuts in some sense, but I think it's a good thing to have, so we don't discourage it. But right now his thing is that Buddha transcended death because he meditated a lot, so if I meditate a lot, then I can also transcend death.
He's five?
Yeah.
No, this headache started when he was three, so we've been suffering a lot for 2 years.
Wow.
But then I talked to some parents, and it's not uncommon for kids to be asking a lot of questions about death.
Mm.